Hi, because long time. Folks, anyone who wants to join a speaker, please raise your hand. You'll notice I changed the. Can you ask a question? Feel free, yeah. Please join. You'll notice that I changed the room name. It was earlier supposed to be all new format. That's not happening. We're just sticking to the old format for now. I haven't done my homework, which means that we'll just be going questions and answers this time. And let's see what happens. Open invitation. Anybody who wants to join a speaker, please feel free. Raise your hand. Join a speaker and we can get started in about 3-4 minutes. Vikas, better now? Gogan has a list question. Which capitals of Indian state is not district? Okay. Sab Kuduri.
Guwahati isn't a district.
I have no idea, man. This reminds me of those Bonvita quiz questions in school. Name the tributaries of the Ganga.
Oh, yeah, capless. This poor. That's a very good point. I'm sorry. So are we doing crowdsourced questions today?
I don't mind, but I don't think we'll have that luxury. So the questions that we're doing today, Kuduri, might be extremely familiar to you.
Okay. So you want me to not participate?
I mean, keep talking. I'd love that.
Okay.
But maybe don't answer until you see nobody else is answering.
Got it.
Bhuvneshwar was correct. Who got Bhuvneshwar? Nobody. What? How did that happen? Anybody
oh,
else?
Yeah, Bhuvneshwar is apparently in the Khorda district. Very interesting.
If you say so. Does anybody else want to join a speaker? Please don't make me talk to only Kothuri. I did this for 4 years in college. It wasn't fun.
Three,
sure.
We do have 32 people. I think you should probably get started.
Okay. Folks, okay, how are we doing this? Gagan, that's okay. Trust me, nobody on this call has a lot of knowledge, except for Jay Bhatnagar. Jay Bhatnagar is the only person who has a lot of knowledge. The rest of us are just morons. We join this call every week.
Well, that's completely not true, right?
Please keep
so on. Basically,
please,
I was looking
please.
At the... I am the seven. I am the seven from the office. Who just looks a lot.
Cool, man. Whatever you say, you seem to get all your answers right. So, apart from Jay Bhatnagar, we're all idiots. Don't worry. Cool. First question. Okay. In what can be seen as a symbolic gesture, in 2017, just before the assembly elections, Modi launched an application, a payment application. And supposedly, the name of the application was a tribute to Jay Bhatnagar. What did you just do?
Jay Bhatnagar clearly does not know anything at all.
There we go. So Gaga, this is the theme of these Wednesday quizzes, the Tuesday quizzes that we used to do, and now Wednesday quizzes that we're doing. I start off a question and Jay Bhatnagar gets it right. So that's correct. Bhim was correct. The funda here being that Bhim was apparently a short
hold
version
on
of
how let's complete the question. Does someone want to tell us
I'll transform
the
question,
app's
right?
Name on ring.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll transform the question to that then. So the app is Bhim. Who was this in honor of? Who was being paid a tribute to?
Does someone, Shantanu wrote it in the chat.
Perfect. So Babasaheb Ambedkar is correct. Or Bhim Rao Ramji Ambedkar. That's what the BR stands for. So Bhim being short for that. So perfect answer, Jay Bhatnagar as usual, and perfect answer, Shantanu as well. Okay. Cool. Next question. Let's try this one. Okay. So this term that I want you to guess is essentially, it's now become a term of abuse in the corporate media. Okay. It is whenever you want to disparagingly reference an activist, if you're not supporting what the activists are doing, but you want to make reference to the activists, you would use this term. Okay. The business media essentially uses this as propaganda against any subversive ideas. So, media has been using this term to marginalize any critics of policies that are driven by businesses. Tell me what this term is. Specifically, it refers to an item that activists often have with them. So in order to answer this question, I want you to visualize an activist. What is this person carrying with them?
Is it Jhola Dhari?
Jhola Dhari is good enough. So Jhola Wala is the answer that I wanted. And perfect answer. Jhola Wala is essentially a slightly abusive term for if you are an actor, since you obviously have that hemp bag or whatever hanging on your side.
Well, so great answer. Seems like today is my lucky day. You are going to ask a question about India and Indian politics, which I have a great knowledge of.
Okay, cool. This is, such categorization has not stopped you in the past. Let's see if that works. I'll try asking something else. I'll try finding something that's... No, okay, we'll stick to India. We won't stick to politics, though. So I'll read out a quote to you. This is from the 1999 Daily Telegraph. Okay, there's this guy, his name is B.R. Shetty. Okay, he is the director of a company. It's called Unique Recoveries. This is important. The company's name is Unique Recoveries. Okay, and this person's quote is as follows. He says, "By the grace of God, success is there. People don't like to be humiliated. And we are also giving work to these people. These people are very educated, but nobody will give them jobs. So I am giving them jobs. I am close to signing a deal with a foreign bank." Who is this person talking about? He heads a company called Unique Recoveries. And he's saying, people don't like to be humiliated. And we are giving work to these people. Who are these people? Random fact, I can tell you that there are about 1.5 lakh such people in Bombay alone. In Mumbai alone, that is. B.R. Shetty is the director of a company called Unique Recoveries. And he says, people don't like to be humiliated. We are giving jobs to someone. Not laborers, not physically disabled. You're right, it does have to be some marginalized community, that's correct. Maybe you could try guessing at what the company does. Okay, so essentially this B.R. Shetty has hired people from this community and he sends them to do some work. I want you to explain to me what work that is. If the company is called Unique Recoveries and he's saying that nobody else gives them jobs, so I'm going to give them jobs. And he says people don't like to be humiliated. This is a very important point.
Dabbawala is a good guess, Kranti, but it's not Dabbawala. But
the
Kranti,
money
I think...
for loans is perfect. So Kranti gets the funda, right? Unique Recoveries works on recovering more money for loans. And so B.R. Shetty sends people from a certain community to recover that money. Shantanu goes for the term Sixers, which I suppose is correct. Good answer. So the B.R. Shetty or Unique Recoveries essentially hires Unics and they are hired as debt recovery agents. So if these people show up at your house, the thesis is that nobody likes to be humiliated. So the eunuchs show up and they threaten to strip or they threaten to shame you, then you'll essentially are much more likely to pay up. So great answer by who all was this? Okay, Kranti getting the funda right and Shantanu for the phrasing Sixers. Good stuff. Okay. Next. Cool. Next question. Sometime in the 1990s, there was a cricket match going on, a test series going on in Sharjah. Okay? And at that point of time, somebody picked up the wicketkeeper saying something to the bowler. And he was asking him to bowl something, bowl a certain ball. I might have made it too simple already. I want you to tell me what might have happened. So basically, the wicketkeeper is telling the bowler something. And when he was telling him to do something, that term that he used is now used to refer to this ball everywhere. I want you to tell me what the name of that ball is. This wicketkeeper was asking the bowler to do something. I don't think you have a lot to work with in the question. 1990s, what else can I tell you? Dusra is correct. So, Gagan, good answer. Do you want to tell me who the bowler might have been in the 1990s? Who was bowling a Dusra? Not Harbhajan.
Not Harbhajan.
Mushtaq is correct. So, Saqlain Mushtaq, the creator of the Dusra, was bowling it in the 1990s. Whoever Pakistan's wicketkeeper at the time might have been was
Moin Khan.
So Moin Khan was telling Saqlain Mushtaq to bowl the other one, bowl the Dusra. And that is now the term for, I think it's, if an off-spinner bowls a leg spin, that's called a Dusra, right? Am I right?
Yep. Okay. An off-spinner bowls a googly, it's called a Dusra. Yeah.
Okay. Perfect. So now, as a follow-up question, tell me a related term. I want you to tell me, one second. First, you had to learn the right one. I didn't understand, Atul. You'll have to join as a speaker to clarify what you mean. Okay. So I want you to tell me a related term. I want you to tell me a different term for another kind of ball. It is a very similar ball to the to Saqlain Mushtaq's Dusra. And specifically, it is called this because the action of releasing the ball is very similar to what players of a different sport do. There we go. Shantanu gets it right. Carrom ball is correct. So the action that you use when you're bowling a carrom ball, which is you hold it between your fingers and then you flick your finger, you're essentially going to be achieving the same thing. And Ashwin is also right. So Gagan somehow seems to have my notes in front of him. He knows that I'm going to ask you the player next. So Ashwin is correct. And the carrom ball is what you call Ashwin's version of the Dusra. Very nice, Shantanu. Perfect. Let's move on. Achha, now that we're here, do you want to tell me what do you call... when a leg spinner bowls an off-spin ball. What do you call that? A mistake? No, that's not a mistake. I suppose it can be a mistake also, but if a leg spinner intentionally bowls an off-spin ball, what do you call that? Kothari, go for it, no?
I don't know. I mean, I would always have thought that's a googly, right?
That is a googly. So googly is pretty much what I'm looking for. Incidentally, what does Shane Warne call his version of the ball? So he's a leg spinner. He's bowling in the other direction. He calls it the wrong one. Perfect. So Shantanu gets that right.
The wrong one. Yeah.
Flipper is slightly different. Does anybody know what the flipper is?
It goes straight and it keeps low, basically.
That's it. So it's the elevation drops dramatically. So as a batsman, you'd be looking for the ball to drop. So a flipper basically loses height or loses speed. Well done. You clearly know all the balls. Well done.
But if I may add one more, yes. Who's the first cricketer to have made the carrom ball really famous? The mystery spinner.
Is it not Ashwin?
No.
Is it Rashid Khan?
No, they got it right. It was Ajinta Mendis, the Sri Lankan mystery spinner, who burst onto the scene for about 2 years and then people figured him out after that.
I thought it took one series to figure him out. Okay, quick.
Anyway, all you.
By the way, this is completely encouraged. If anybody else wants to tell me any fundas related to this, this is how we pad time, folks. So feel free to join as listener. Feel free to add anything you want. Okay, next question. In 1957, All India Radio, they started broadcasting songs on Vivid Bharti. Okay, and the headquarters from where this broadcasting was done was very close to a particular town. Okay, now all over India, people could still... request certain songs to be played by calling up. But of course, calling up wasn't super common. People in that town, though, people who lived in the town nearest to where All India Radio was broadcasting, they would often send postcards. They would send postcards down to the headquarters saying, play this song, play that song. As a result of this, if you were listening to All India Radio, you would often hear the name of this town. You would often hear that so-and-so from this town has requested so-and-so song. So the town has a slightly weird name. It's a funny name. And it showed up so often on All India Radio that today people have often assumed that the town is not real. It's just a funny sounding or a made up town that is basically India's equivalent of Timbuktu, which by the way is also a real town. So if you say Timbuktu, but you mean middle of nowhere, then what is India's equivalent of that? Where was All India Radio broadcasting from? To crack this question, I want you to think of an Indian town that has a funny name that sounds kind of like it's in the middle of nowhere. This is slightly trivia question, so if you've never heard the town, obviously you're not going to be able to get it. Not Ghaziabad. Kothuri, I might need a save at some point. I don't think this is going anywhere. I can give you a random hint. The town is famous for Kalakhand. I don't know what that even is.
Oh, Kalakhand is so sweet.
Panchkula is not right. And the usage, I think, should be clear. If you've read Garfield, in Garfield, they use the place Abu Dhabi to mean middle of nowhere. John keeps threatening Garfield that he'll send him to Abu Dhabi. So what's India's... Oh, Jhumri Talai is correct. Sanjana gets it perfectly right. So somebody did. Somebody over here was listening to All India Radio. Who knew? Jhumri Talai is the name of the town. And people were often sending postcards from that place. So you would often hear that so-and-so from Jhumri Talaiya has requested the song. The name sounds funny, which is why people have often assumed that it's made up and Jhumri Talaiya is not really a place. Yes, the place is real. There we go. So Gaga,
it's in Jharkhand, in the district of Kodarma. So yes, it is real.
Good stuff, Sanjana, for getting that.
Fun fact in this, if someone has seen Jabba Jasus, then both Tumbaktu and Jhumri Talaiya are in a song. Mera Rao hai Jhumri Talaiya or something. So then we'll sing in that song.
I will look that up. Thank you. Okay.
I am looking it up right now. And yes, he is indeed right. There's a song called Jhumri Talaiya from Jabba Jasus. The song is composed by Pritam with lyrics by Nilesh Mishra and sung by Arjit Singh. Mera Gaon Jhumri Talaiya hai, Tera Gaon Shayad Timbuktu. Jinko milna hota milte hain, chahe fir ho jaye udan chhuwa.
Amazing.
I have watched this movie many times, but I couldn't guess. Timbuktu was a very good hint in this space.
Fantastic. And if I may add on a very quick piece of trivia, Herman, you can try and guess this as well. This is absolute proper trivia, but the All India Radio signature tune, does anyone know who composed it? Like, I think a lot of you might be familiar. I'm sorry?
S.D. Burman?
No, it's not.
Kishore Kumar?
No.
R.D. Burman?
Surprisingly, it's not an Indian at all.
Oh, okay.
Is it Iqbal? If it's not Indian, it has to be either a Pakistani or Bangladeshi. So I'm going with Iqbal.
Okay, so I'll just rid you of your misery. This was a Jewish refugee called Walter Kaufman who actually composed it.
Shantanu got it, apparently.
Yeah? Oh, yeah, Shantanu got it. Kaufman. Perfect. So, congratulations. Anyway, all you, Harmo.
Okay, we'll move on. Okay, I'm going to read out another quote to you. This one is from a certain Charles Paxton. He won an Ig Nobel Prize for this. Oh, wait, Jay Bhatnagar has something to add.
Who composed? No.
No, actually, Atul was asking what was the question, so yeah.
Oh, sorry.
I was asking.
Perfect. I assume that you were asking who composed the Airtel cartoon.
No. I was answering to Atul. Atul asked what was the question, so I was repeating it.
Okay, next question is, the text that I'm about to read to you is by Charles Paxton. He won an Ig Nobel Prize for what he's trying to find an explanation for. Okay, it's a bit odd, the quote. Listen to it. So he's giving an explanation for something. You have to figure out what that is. He says, many large baleen whales have long snake-like penises. Okay, he's saying whales have massive penises. If the animal did indeed fall on its back, then its ventral surface would have been uppermost. And if the whale was aroused, then the usually retracted penis would have been visible. Okay, he's theorizing that there are situations where if a whale is in a certain position, then the usually retracted penis of a whale would have been visible. Kranti is reacting to this. Kranti, please stop being a prude. We're talking about whale penises. This is completely normal.
Okay. It's Wildlife. I mean,
who doesn't talk about whale penises on Wednesday nights? That's what Wednesday nights are for. Now, he says the penises of the North Atlantic white whale and Pacific gray whale can be 1.8 meters long and or 1.7 meters long, and they could be taken by some naive witness as something else. Okay? So, I want you to figure out what he's trying to give the explanation for. What is he saying? Okay, somebody probably saw a whale's penis at a distance and thought it was something else. What is he giving an explanation for? meters is somebody's height. I mean, yeah. Not a lighthouse, no. Lighthouses don't need such exotic explanation. Not a seal either. Seal is a good guess, I suppose. But
could I give a hint?
Yeah, I could.
I mean, think of something that's typically considered unexplained, and this person is trying to come in and give a logical explanation for something that people have been unable to explain as such. And this person's explanation is that, you know, these whale penises are about 1.8 meters long. And if the whales are, you know, swimming on their backs as such, then, you know, this is probably what we're spotting.
So Harsh has asked for the repeat of the question. He's saying that the line that we're reading out is by a certain Charles Paxton. He's saying somebody probably saw a whale that was on its back. Its ventral surface was uppermost, and if it was aroused, then its 1.8 meter long penis was probably visible. The Loch Ness Monster is not right, but you're not too far away.
So I think we can give it.
Sorry. Uthi, what did you say?
I think you can give it.
Okay, fine. So Loch Ness is good enough. That's pretty much what he was trying to explain. He's trying to explain sea serpents of any kind. So the Loch Ness Monster is a famous, a famous serpent that lives supposedly lives in Loch Ness, which is a lake in Scotland. But Charles Paxton here is saying that this is probably the explanation for any sort of sea serpent. So if you heard any legend about a dragon that lives in the sea, or any serpent that rises up and captures a ship and goes down, these tales probably arose from somebody seeing a whale's penis from very, very far away, that it happened to be in a very good mood, and they thought it was a monster. It was not a monster, or I suppose you could metaphorically call it a monster, but it was not an actual monster. So good stuff. Whoever
said Harman, can I pile on to this? I have a very interesting question.
Please go.
So since we're talking about Ig Nobel prizes, so just to give you context again, Ig Nobel is the satirical prizes. They're awarded every year by this particular magazine, and it's specializing in this humorous coverage and discussions of scientific developments. Right? It's a play on the word Nobel. So it's a satire on Nobel Prizes. There have been two Indian prime ministers that have won the Ig Nobel Prize. Can you tell me who the two Indian prime ministers are who won the Ig Nobel Prize? No. One was quite recent. And Harman, you can go for this as well.
Harshvardhan is going to be brute forcing this.
Yes. I mean, I'm not going to say yes to any of those. But Harman, do you want to at least give one?
Okay. Is it Atal Bihari Vajpayee for some poem?
It's not for a poem, but Atal Bihari Vajpayee is indeed right. So remember, these are all scientific, right? So Atal Bihari Vajpayee won because he basically... just give me a second. So yeah. He, in 1998, he won the Ig Nobel for Peace because he called his detonation of a nuclear weapon aggressively peaceful. So because of that, he got the Ig Nobel Peace Prize. And Shantanu gets it right. It is Modi and Vajpayee. What did Modi win it for? Which I think is extremely relevant.
Was it scientific?
Yeah. So last year, the most recent Ig Nobel Prize for medical education was won by Bolsonaro, Boris Johnson, Alexander Lukashenko, Donald Trump, Erdogan, Putin, and Modi, along with a couple of other prime ministers. And this was for using the COVID-19 viral pandemic to teach the world that politicians can have a more immediate effect on life and death than scientists and doctors can. So yeah, anyway, that's the follow-up. Back to you, Herman.
Folks, you can react to that. I noticed there's a sob emoji. So in case you were looking for the appropriate reaction, that it's there on your screen. There we go. Cool. Okay, next question. This is a shit question. I will skip this. Okay. So this term, need more cricket questions. Kothuri, can you oblige with the cricket question?
I couldn't update you till then.
So we'll start with something else. This term, I don't need you to guess the term, but I'll describe it to you anyway. This term was coined by somebody named Marianne Hirsch to describe a relationship that a generation bears to trauma of those who came before. So essentially, if your parents or if your grandparents went through some kind of trauma, then your relationship with trauma can be described as blank. So basically, these experiences that you personally don't remember, but you remember by means of stories and by means of images. You probably read about stuff that happened in the news. Somebody has told you what previous generations of your community or whatever went through. So you have some relationship with trauma. It's not a direct relationship. And now it seems to mean something more generic, but she came up with it in context of a certain event. So this lady, Marianne Hirsch, was actually reviewing a particular book. I want you to tell me which book that is. The review of which book created this term?
Is it by V.S. Naipaul? I don't know the name. There's a book by V.S. Naipaul where he talks about.
That's a very good guess. V.S. Naipaul wrote that House of something. No? What is it called?
I don't know the name, but it talks about the oppression which his parents had.
Yeah, and V.S. Naipaul is based in the West Indies. His parents are Indian. So the answer does fit very well. It's not right in this case, though. The answer we're looking for is not somebody who's an Indian immigrant or anything like that. You're looking for somebody slightly different. This is a very famous book. I can give more details about the book, but that might make it too easy. You're looking for a book in which somebody specifically talks about how their parents went through a very, very hard time.
Is it Harry Potter?
It's not Harry Potter. You may have read a different book than I did. I'm looking for a book in which parents went through a particularly tough time. I can get more specific now because I don't know how popular the book is now. The writer in this case was talking about, okay, so Gagan has guessed Diary of Anne Frank. The book I'm talking about also talks about the parents' experiences with the same tragedy. So this author's parents went through the Holocaust and survived. And this author wrote about their experiences. Mouse is perfect. So Shantanu gets it right. Mouse is this very famous graphic novel, probably one of the most famous graphic novels that you've ever heard of, in which Art Spiegelman, he's the artist and the writer, has written about how his father survived the Holocaust camps. So great answer by Shantanu. While describing Mouse, while reviewing Mouse, this lady, Marianne Hirsch, created this term. The term, by the way, was called post-memory. I wouldn't expect anybody to guess that, but the term is called post-memory. It describes what your relationship is with trauma if your previous generations had gone through something. So great answer again, Chantra.
I do have a cricket question now, Harman, if you want me to.
Cricket question.
Okay. So Sachin Tendulkar. Good one. Right? So Sachin Tendulkar. What was the first international cricket team that he took the field against? The first ever game in which he took the field against an international cricket team was which team? It's not Pakistan, it's not England, it's not Australia, it's not Pakistan again. So I think Sanjana, it's Pakistan. So I think it's not Zimbabwe, it's not Bangladesh, definitely. I think you're looking, it is a test playing nation. I think you're looking for the 1989 India versus Pakistan game. And that's what you're trying to be a little emphatic or about. But that's not the right answer. Again, let me rephrase this question. Let me say it again. Which was the first team that he took the field against?
So he wasn't in the playing 11, but he was like a substitute or something.
Yes. Perfect.
Is he playing against some county cricket team?
No, I said international cricket team.
Okay. I mean, at this point, we could just go through the test playing nations, right?
Yes, and none of you have still gotten it right. None of you, not even one person has mentioned the
Sri
right
Lanka.
Country. Nope. Not Sri Lanka, not New Zealand, not Scotland, not Bermuda, not West Indies, not Netherlands, not Zimbabwe, not East Africa, not Kenya, not Bangladesh.
Is it test playing now or was it test playing then?
Test playing now, test playing then.
South Africa?
Not South Africa.
How many test playing nations are there?
There are very, very few. And there is one big one that you're missing out. Not Afghanistan. Not New Zealand. I'm going to just let this go on for another 15, 20 seconds. Kranti can relax.
Is it India?
It is India. Harman. What? Got it right. So it is India. The first game that Sachin ever took to the field against an international team was against India. Now, which team did he play for?
Railways or something.
No, it's an international team again.
What?
It's Pakistan. So in 1987, during a tour game between Pakistan and India, Miandad and Abdul Qadir just went off the field. So Sachin was subbed on as a fielder for them. And Sachin actually, his first ever quote-unquote international debut was actually for Imran Khan's team against the Indian team in 1987.
But how does this work though? Like they don't have enough players, so we lend them some.
Yeah. This was not a test series as such. It was a tour game. So yeah, it was India versus Pakistan as a tour game. It wasn't one of those. It was like a practice match kind of thing.
Okay. I have a follow-up cricket question.
Mm-hmm.
You just remembered one of my favorite cricket pundits. In 1950, India and Pakistan had their first test series. It was held in Pakistan, and it was four games, and it is widely considered one of the most boring test series of all time.
1950, 5-0.
Yes.
Okay.
I want you to tell me why. Why was this test series so incredibly boring? Cricket commentators, cricket reviewers, they said it was an incredibly boring series. Someone just defended. Again, not wrong.
There was no limit on the number of days. It wasn't a 5-day test. It was unlimited day test.
You're right. It wasn't a 5-day test. It was actually 4-day test. For some reason, tests at that time were played over 4 days.
Okay.
So, no, there's nothing objective like this. These are commentators have commented that the teams were playing way too defensively. Any idea why they were playing too defensively?
1950.
Yes.
Nobody wanted to lose, clearly. So did they get into sort of a soft agreement to ensure that, you know, nobody had to return home and get brickbats?
That's pretty much it. So in 1950 was the first test series that India-Pakistan played, and neither of the teams could afford to lose because immediately after partition and bloodshed, you can't lose a test series. So both teams played ultra-defensive cricket and every single match ended in a draw. So, well done, Kothari. Sahi kiya is apparently Gagan's reaction.
Thanks, Gagan.
Okay, we'll jump out of cricket. Okay, this next question is about a certain type of cooking. Okay, it's a certain cooking method. And I'll tell you one limitation of the cooking method. The browning that you've seen on meat, you know, whenever you're cooking meat and the exterior turns brown and there's a hard crust, that happens only at temperatures that are above the boiling point of water. Okay? Which means that if you like crust, if you like the flavors that are there in crust that comes from browning, then those are very, I mean, if you like seeing those on meat, if you like seeing those on steak, then those flavors and those textures are things that you can never see in this kind of cooking. Another fact that I can tell you about this kind of cooking is it is a safety issue. Most plastics, they release some chemicals whenever they're heated, and this might pose health risks. So these are two pieces of information about a kind of cooking. I want you to tell me what that kind of cooking is. In case nobody knows the name, a description of the type of cooking can also be enough.
Sorry, can you repeat, Herman?
Okay, so we're describing a kind of cooking, and there are two issues with it that I have described. The first issue with it is a browning of meat or the development of a crust, it only happens above the boiling point of water. water. So that's one thing that you cannot achieve with this kind of cooking because it happens below the boiling point of water. The other issue is plastic. When you're cooking with plastic, plastic releases chemicals. And that is a health issue. So you've got two hints about this kind of cooking. You know that plastic is involved. You also know that it is done below the boiling point of water.
Is it the way like how then you don't exactly put them into the fire, but you put them into hot water, something like that kind of funda?
Can you describe that again?
So basically how momos are prepared, you don't cook them in water. You put, you boil water and in that you put another, another container and you put momos inside it.
So momos are typically...
So is it that kind of funda?
You're not very far from the answer. Steaming is not right. Shantanu goes for simmering, which is actually again another element of the answer, and Divya gets it perfectly. So the cooking right is called, I don't know how to pronounce it. Is it sous vide?
Sous vide.
Okay. So sous vide is the kind of cooking. And Shantanu also, you know what, it takes some imaginary points for that. Simmering is basically the funda. So the idea is that you wrap your food in airtight plastic and you dip it in agitated water, which is always kept at a temperature that's below boiling. But it's hot enough that you can cook. So it's a very fancy form of cooking. It is used in a lot of fancy restaurants. And somehow, Divya happened to know this. There are some health issues and there are some flavors that you cannot achieve with this. But why? Kranti, there's a lot of cooking that happens without much of a reason. I think it's for the same reason that George Mallory said that he wanted to climb Everest. Does anybody know why George Mallory wanted to climb Everest?
Because it is there to climb?
Because it is there. George Mallory's response, when why should we climb Everest? Because it is there. So great answer by Divya George for that one. Some science question. I'm commissioning that from Kothuri. I will move on to the next question. Kothuri will look for a science question in the
middle. Oh, okay. Fine.
Okay. This next question is about a certain term again. It has a very long and complex history. Today, you use it to refer to a type of citrus fruit. Okay. It's a relatively rare citrus fruit, so maybe don't go in that direction. I'll tell you more about the origin. Okay? It's an Arabic word. It derives from an Arabic word. Originally, it used to refer to anybody who's not a Muslim. Okay? Anybody who's not a Muslim was called this word. Over the centuries, Jay Bhatnagar has already there. Jay Bhatnagar gets it right. It's kafir. I'll still complete the question. Over the centuries, the word kafir has come to mean, has come to be used to describe black Africans by white colonialists. And in the 20th century, X was basically considered a slur. You know, any words that you can think of that are very extremely offensive today, like the N-word, for example, X had, the word kafir had a very similar connotation, at least in the 20th century. And by the way, more recently, people have pointed out that there have been statements, recorded statements by a certain figure, where he was using this term as well. And he was using them in the following context. He says, we were locked up with the kafirs. Not a single European officer called us Indians. We were all called blank or blank. So, do you want to tell me who this person was? Whose quote am I reading out?
Can you repeat the quote? Sorry.
So the quote is, this person who's normally a very revered person, he had said, we were locked up with the kafirs. Not a single European officer called us Indians. We were called blank or blank. Who would this person be? Remember, the term is used by white colonialists to describe black Africans. So who can you think of who was working against white colonialists and was probably teaming up with whom they described as kafirs? Gandhi is right. So Gogan gets it right. Mahatma Gandhi, when he was in South Africa, was often jailed with people that he referred to as kafirs. And he pointed out that Europeans did not call us Indians either. He said the Europeans called us blank or blank. Any guesses about what those are? What, again, the Europeans are trying to be as offensive as possible. So they call the black Africans kafirs. What do they call Indians? Again, fairly trivial question. So you either know it or you don't. Is any idea what South African white colonialists would call Indians? Not fuck you. It's a very good guess. Sir. Not fuck you. Filth, probably. I mean, they probably did call us filth. I'm not sure. Snake charmers is a great guess. but I think that's a slightly more recent stereotype. So at that time, no. I'll just go ahead and give you the answer if nobody's getting a chance. The white colonialists who were calling Africans kafirs were calling Indians coolies or Samis. Oh, Shantanu gets it right. Shantanu tends to get these answers, you know, after a gap, even if it's trivia. You know, precisely like 2 or 3 minutes later, he gets the answer. Kosari, you may have noticed this as well.
I haven't seen. I'm sorry.
Okay. Cool. We'll jump ahead to the next question. I think, this is my last question.
I do have some science questions before yours, if you want.
Go for it.
Okay. So for these science questions, I'd love for people to just feel free and spam on chat, right? I'm sure there could be multiple, guesses for these. And whoever gets these right first gets these right, I guess, gets the imaginary points. But okay, first up.
Kranti has started spamming, by the way.
Oh, Kranti is already water, oxygen, hydrogen, close. Okay, so the first question is about animals, Kranti. All right. So what is the first? Am I seeing some guesses yet? Okay, I'm not. All right. So which was the first animal as such, like wildlife, to go to space? Like, give me, it's not a dog. It's not a dog. It's not a monkey. It's not Dora. I don't know what Dora is. It's not rats. It's not bacteria. Oh, Jay Bhatnagar is catching us on technicality there. Jay Bhatnagar might technically be right, but I'm talking about things observable by the naked eye. It's not a chimpanzee. It's not a bird.
Wait, so bacteria might technically be right?
I mean, was bacteria... I mean, the first ever ship before there were animals sent, right, was right, there right. Bacteria in the ship? Yeah, perhaps. Right. Is anyone going for this? Okay, fine.
Give hint.
These are annoying little things that lot of us... Huh?
Is it a pigeon?
No, little.
Mice?
But they're also like dangerous because we get some diseases from it.
Mosquitoes?
No. Okay, I'll just desert. Your misery. I'll just this thing. But basically, the first animals in space were a group of fruit flies, like the tsetse flies. These were the first ones that were launched to an altitude about 42 miles, way before Laika and all of these things were, right? So that is the first one. And okay, so the second one. Now I think everybody kind of knows that. The most dangerous animal or wildlife, again, in terms of human deaths, is easily the mosquito, right? But which is the most dangerous land animal or land mammal, let's say, that is the world's deadliest, that kills the most number of human beings per year? And Divya George gets it in the first ever try. The hippopotamus kills about 500 people a year. They're extremely aggressive creatures, very sharp teeth. I'm sure a lot of you might think they look beautiful, cute, smell really nice.
More people die from hippo accidents than snake accidents?
No, land mammals, I said.
Oh, mammals, okay.
Yeah, I said land mammals. So hippopotamus, way more. Snakes, approximately about 50,000 people are killed every year. Dogs, could you guess approximately how many people die a year? If snakes kill 50,000, how many do you think dogs kill in a year, approximately? 23 exactly. Not sure if that's the right answer.
I'd say more than snakes, right?
No, actually, it's about half that much, 25.
The way you said 23 exactly, I thought it's...
No, it's not. So 25,000 people approximately per year. I mean, wherever there is rabies, about 99% of the rabies infections are carried by dogs. Tsetse flies, also about 10,000 people die every year because of tsetse flies. Crocodiles kill about 1,000 humans per year, much, much more than sharks. In fact, there are some beautiful articles that you can all read about as to how dying, you know, a shark killing you is less likely than you dying by lightning strike or something like that, if I'm not wrong. So something like that. Okay, but Harman, my last animal question, if that's okay with you, is, and I almost have found it. Just a second.
Snakes don't harm us intentionally.
Okay, fine. I mean, sharks don't harm us intentionally. All right. So, camels, they have humps. What do they store in them? If Divya George gives you some time, I'd love for you. Oh, fantastic. So everyone's already put it in there. Kranti is the only one who clearly does not know this. Everybody else knew this. This was fat and not water. So they use the fat. You were going to say water also? Yeah. Good. So they have fat reserves that they use whenever they're hungry and or they need energy. And in fact, the humps actually do droop if they use up all the fat reserves in there. So you might find camels where the hump is not as prominent because they've used up the fat reserves and it's drooping and saggy and all of those pieces. And it doesn't store water, even though it can go, they can go a long, long bit with very little water. So yeah. Yeah, that's it for the few little trick questions with science. Please, Harman, all yours.
I was going to wrap up anyway. I think I have just one question left, and this can be our last question for the day. And Ramni has decided to join us. Thank you, Ramni, for joining us for the absolute last question. Okay, so in Japanese culture, it is believed that these things bring you good luck. Okay? I want you to tell me what that thing is. I can give you a couple of clues, or actually I can give you an explanation for why they're considered good luck. These things translate to be victorious, the name of these things. It translates in Japanese to be victorious or you can surely win. And this is a coincidence. Nobody, and Ramni has made an entry by getting it perfectly right. So Kit Kat is the right answer. In Japanese culture, it's considered good luck. So you'd often go around gifting these to students. If students are appearing for examination, you give them a Kit Kat because the name Kit Kat means be victorious in Japanese. So it's a fairly popular brand in Japan. Apparently, they have like 200 different flavors also, including green tea, cherry blossom, soy sauce, baked potato. These are all flavors of Kit Kat that you can get. So perfect, Tomni. Good entry and good exit as well. That was our last question for today. Thank you so much, everybody, for showing up. I know we did this after, I think, a 3-week absence. But a bunch of you were already here on time, so thank you for that. We'll do this again next week, and next week hopefully I'll have a slightly better format, but we'll do teams and stuff. I said that last week as well, so let's see. Let's see you next week, Wednesday at 9 p.m. Tata.
Good night.